Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Dan Proft, Democrat Philip Beverly, and Libertarian Sean Bennett. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to send us an email message, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com, whether it's either tonight's broadcast or past broadcast that you might have missed. Last week on this program, you may have recalled that we were talking much of the program about what Joe Biden, the vice president, had said to David Gregory on Meet the Press when he came out personally in favor of same-sex marriage. And people were wondering whether the vice president was speaking out of turn. Well, as it turned out, he might have been doing that. But again, the story of same-sex marriage and it being thrust into the national political debate really was etched in stone midweek when President Obama, after going back and forth a little bit, doing a little semi-damage control in the early part of the week, went on with Robin Robinson on Good Morning America. And when asked about gay marriage, this is what he had to say. Quote, "I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married," end of quote. This, of course, from the same president who basically said having gays serve openly in the military, openly gay, serving openly in the military was okay with him. So that was a significant shift. And now coming out in favor of gay marriage. Philip Beverly is our card-carrying Democrat this evening. You're a college professor. Does that statement make his reelection easier or more difficult in your view?
I don't think it's either. I think the people who are going to not vote for Barack are still not going to vote for him on this, and that there's an element of the independent voters that I think he gets, primarily because he made a stand on it. And I would say in the past administration, though I may not have agreed with George W. Bush, what I appreciated about him is that I knew where he stood on things. And with President Obama, sometimes it seems like there's a little bit too much deliberation for him internally.
Dan Proft, does this help or hurt his reelection efforts?
I don't think it helps. I think it hurts ultimately. I mean, 32 states have had ballot initiatives on redefining marriage, and 32 states have voted usually overwhelmingly not to redefine marriage, including North Carolina, which, according to the Democrats, is one of their swing states pickups. And, oh, by the way, is where they have their convention. And a couple days before President Obama made his announcement that their ballot initiative went down 60-40. Wasn't close. So I don't think it helps him. I think this is part of President Obama's strategy to and necessary strategy to rev up the base, because you have a base that's a little bit dispirited by the performance of this president, to raise money. I mean, certainly to raise money from the gay community, and to make people hate each other as much as possible, because he has to employ a divide and conquer strategy to get to the electoral count he needs.
Sean Bennett is our libertarian. Help or hurt the president's reelection efforts, in your view?
I think it might help him, actually, because if you look in 2008, one in four gay and lesbian citizens voted Republican in 2008. But in 2010, at the midterms, 31% voted Republican. And I think that he's going to see those swing voters in states like Ohio and Florida thinking twice about whether or not they're going to vote for him. I don't think he's really going to lose any of the other people who were going to vote for him anyway. I think that if somebody wasn't going to vote for him because of the LGBT issue, they already decided that when he signed Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
I think it's bigger than that, though. And Mitt Romney's initial communication on this, I thought, was poor. What he initially said was, my preference is that marriage is the union of one man and one woman. Well, it's not your preference. It either is or it isn't. And he improved his communication with the commencement address he gave at Liberty University over the weekend. But what Mitt Romney, I think, should say into this, because this is not going to be an issue that animates a lot of voters. Obviously, the fiscal issues, the economic issues are going to be more preeminent. But what Romney should do is weave this into the larger narrative about President Obama. Here's somebody who wants to transform everything you know to be American, everything you know about the building blocks of Western civilization. And this is just another example of it. So if you don't like the guy who is trying to transform our economy into some socialist European-style economy, then you don't like the guy who's trying to transform the institution of the family either. And I think that's how you weave it in without making this a referendum on the redefinition of marriage.
You say that this might be a profile in courage. You didn't use those terms, but do you think this is a profile in courage?
He could have stayed where he was in his position and really lost nothing. But to just come out and say it, does it rev up the base? It revs up the Democratic base as much as Mitt Romney's Liberty University commencement speech revs up throwing the raw meat to the Republican base.
And by the way, let's just mention, because this was the excerpt from Mitt Romney's speech yesterday at Liberty University. Jerry Falwell's was the founder of the university. It seems to me that every 4 years, some Republican candidate is at that school giving a commencement, and it becomes big, big news. Again, coincidentally, he speaks just a few days after the president made his comment known on gay same-sex marriage. He said, quote, "Culture matters. As fundamental as these principles are, they may become topics of democratic debate. So it is today with the enduring institution of marriage. Marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman," end of quote. That was the big applause line of the entire speech. Coming at the time that it came, would you agree that the most important thing that both what the president said and what Mitt Romney said is the lines are clearly drawn here?
I don't think the lines are clearly drawn.
Why are they not?
I think that Romney is devolving on this issue. If you look as recently as 1 or 2 years ago, he said, while he didn't prefer it if a state ruled that same-sex marriage was invalid, that he would in some select circumstances allow for civil unions, he said that even this week when he said, I am not in favor of civil unions, there's still text out there saying that he was in favor of domestic partnership, visitation, benefits, things like that. So he's really trying to consolidate his message into something that is more simplistic than the issue at hand.
What is President Obama trying to do? I mean, in 2004, as a candidate for U.S. Senate in this state, he opposed, based on his Christian faith, he opposed the idea of redefining marriage.
Well, I agree with you.
That has evolved. The other thing I would say, too, look, I mean, on this simplicity President Obama said the same thing. It's up for the states to decide. This is such an important issue, but he doesn't want federal action. He wants it to leave it to the states because he's trying to play.
I think if anything, he's making it more complicated.
Well, he's trying to play.
He's trying to play it both ways because he knows.
Well, it's also, but the evolution, the evolution of one's position, politicians frequently use that. And one of the what
is he evolving or is culture evolving?
Well, the cultural is evolving, and poll numbers are evolving as well. Yeah. And in our most recent poll, I think it was 51% support gay marriage, even though in the states where it's been put up for a vote,
32,
always loses. 1-800-723-8289. That's the topic tonight. Give us a call. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We're talking about the president's stand on gay marriage, supporting it now after, by the way, to anybody at this panel, was anybody really surprised? Hasn't he always really believed this in your heart? Don't you think he's believed this for a long time? It's just the time to do it.
I'm not surprised he took the position. I'm not sure that the president actually believes a whole lot. I think I've said ever since he was in the Illinois State Senate, for that matter, that he was a cipher for the radical left, and I don't think that's changed just because his job title has changed.
But if the radical left, would they not support gay marriage?
Yeah, well, they support tearing down institutions of Western civilization. Right. So, yes, they do.
So the question is, as you look at it from again, a political situation, are they thinking around the strategy table just a mile from where we do this program? Are they saying, you know what, if we do this, it's going to force Romney to do this, and we're going to lose these states, but we may pick up more states. How deep is this discussion going on? Because you've looked at the numbers, the Electoral College vote. Does this where does this help him and where does it hurt him in your view?
I don't think it does either of those, especially given that this was done in May. We're 6 months out from the election. I think this will be so far in the rearview mirror come September, October, and in the run-up to the election. It'll be yesterday's news if it's brought up later. That's why I think it doesn't really have the same sort of impact. That I think it was the president went to the strategist on this one instead of them coming to him and said, look, I'm just going to say this. We're going to be done with it. We're going to move on and focus on whatever we can get traction on that will resonate with voters closer.
What's your view on that?
Perhaps I'm a little more cynical about this, but as of this morning, Obama's campaign had about $200 million in cash in it, and he announced this. Raised $1 million from the gay community in the first 90 minutes or overall in the first 90 minutes after he made the announcement, went to a large Hollywood fundraiser that night thrown by George Clooney, is having another fundraiser with LGBT community members hosted by Ricky Martin in New York on Monday. I think that they're short of this sort of $1 billion campaign that they've touted. And he's looking at the numbers and he's saying, well, you know, I can do this now or I can do this closer to the convention when it's on the platform. And if I do this now, I can raise this money and I can keep this divide and conquer strategy that I'm employing right now in order to distract the American people from the weak job numbers.
Can we clarify who's being divided and conquered in this strategy? Because I'm unclear when I hear that sort of rhetoric and that narrative. Maybe I'm just not smart enough to understand the sophistication of it. Where's the division in a guy who spent his entire life trying to build bridges with people? And if you listen to, I think, a prominent psychiatrist say, the man to his detriment has tried to extend his hand too much and been smacked down by Republicans who hate the man.
Smacked down by Republicans. He had control. He had the run of the place for the first 2 years, and he and congressional Democrats took full advantage of it. The divide and conquer is very simple. The Barack Obama is nothing new. This is the same old playbook, same old big government, big liberal playbook. This is race and gender identity politics. Number one. So there's part of your divide and conquer.
And who's being divided from whom?
When you play race and gender identity politics,
and
what was the race politics beside the man being African American? What is the war on women? What is this avatar Julia that he's created? This, you know,
the what?
The avatar, the storyline, the Julia that he's created, and they put on their website and they're putting money behind to develop this story about Julia, this woman who's born, then enters a Head Start program. It attracts a single woman in America under Barack Obama as compared to under Mitt Romney through her life of getting one benefit after another from the beneficent federal government. And all of this is going to be taken away from poor single women if Mitt Romney's elected.
And that's not
divide and conquer politics, then I don't know how better to define it
and
for you.
More simply, conquered?
I think that the more intractable the issue, abortion's a very good example. It's an intractable issue. Either you think that life starts here, or you think life starts there, or you think somewhere in between, or you think that it's something else. You're not going to get people to agree on that. The more intractable the issue, and gays fall into that category, the treatment of women, racial issues fall into those categories, the more likely it's going to divide your base and highlight the differences between you and your opponent.
So if it's going to divide your base,
you are for regular of visitors to this visitors to our show. They know that you're the former head of the Log Cabin Republicans, which is a national group of gay Republicans.
Yes, that's
you're
correct.
Now more of a libertarian than a Republican. But can you be with this new issue? As you say, many of your friends and colleagues, you know, maybe overwhelmingly in support of the Democratic Party and specifically the president, because they think that this has been a profile in courage. He did something that they wanted him to do for a long time. Although, again, he's giving it off to the states. He could do more. But again, everybody thinks that they, you know, whatever the constituency group, they always want.
I do give him credit.
My question to you is this. Can you be supportive of the president because of what he said about gays and lesbians being able to marry, but you'll still vote for him because he's a Republican, because you agree with him on or Mitt Romney on issues.
I think that it's...
Can you
it's,
be gay and vote Republican?
Absolutely. I think that for many Republicans who happen to be gay, that gay social issues are just one of a kaleidoscope of issues which are of importance to them, including the economy and other social issues. In this particular circumstance, I fully give credit to Obama for taking what I consider to be a historic step to be the first president to come out while they're... in office and say that they support gay marriage. Do I think that there's a semantic problem with what he said? Yes, absolutely. I think that there's an alternate solution.
And I want to get to that in the next segment. A question of the convention. You mentioned the convention in North Carolina, which just a couple of days before this basically said overwhelmingly a constitutional ban against same-sex marriage in North Carolina. Charlotte is where the convention is going to be. Are you concerned about the possibility of demonstrators that would be perceived by the media as anti-gay demonstrators circling and demonstrating at that convention? Because you know there are going to be pro-gay demonstrators that probably are going to be engaged in that convention as well. And the television coverage of that, how it plays in other states, could that have a political impact? Because there's going to be 4 days of network coverage. And since there's no other story really at that convention, maybe this becomes a big story that has some benefit, either positively or negatively, for the president or for Romney.
Well, I mean, and this presumes, of course, that we don't take the Democratic governor of North Carolina's admonition to cancel the midterm elections or the presidential election this year because things are just so bad and we should just let President Obama stay in office to fix all these things. This is the heft of the Democratic Party, Bev Perdue. Incredible. But I think I'm not worried about that at all, because to the extent that you have pro-life protesters, pro-family protesters, people that are exercising their conscience and making their point, they do so in a peaceful way. We don't talk about Tea Party members. We don't talk about pro-life protesters, pro-family protesters in the same way we worry about Occupy Wall Street protesters or other radical leftist protesters like are coming to Chicago next week for NATO. What about Reverend Phelps, though?
What about Reverend Phelps? If Reverend Phelps shows up from Kansas, who's probably the most virulent anti-gay public figure in the United States, if he shows up, and even if he has eight people, you know the media is going to cover him. Like he's got 800
people. Yeah, but you're going to have a great example is what happened over the weekend with what Rand Paul said, and that Tony Perkins rebuked him for the statement that he made, which was flippant on the issue of redefining marriage. So this is a serious issue. We shouldn't make fun of everybody. We should have civil, polite, intelligent discourse on the issue. So you're going to have pro-family and pro-life leaders that understand the importance of the issue, that are not going to tolerate incendiary rhetoric, that are not going to tolerate flippancy. And I think that I think the idea that there's going to be some bad optics coming out of the convention that would hurt the Republican brand nationwide, I think is a false concern.
Does everybody agree with that?
I think that Fred Phelps shows up to every event that may or may not have the LGBT community there. I mean, he comes to every Pride parade. He goes to when I was present when the marriages started in Massachusetts in 2004, he was there and they sort of put him in a box, down the street, and no one cared.
Yeah,
and I think that there's a good possibility that at the DNC convention they're going to want to downplay that it's in North Carolina because of this, and they're going to want to upplay other aspects of their platform, which is maybe a reason why they brought this out now.
But I would say this issue is not going to go away if for no other reason than it's going to be asked of both the candidates at every debate. You can guarantee that, because the media is obsessed with this issue.
Right.
So they will ask those questions.
Issues.
Yeah. So it's going to be part of the conversation, because it's going to be part of the news stories that come out of every debate as you get down to the 60-day sprint to the finish this fall.
Can you oppose the president on this issue without being viewed as a bigot, in your view, Philip Beverly? Or are the Democrats and is the left going to paint anyone who opposes the president on this issue, who opposes same-sex marriage, as somehow a bigot?
I think it's a really complicated issue depending on how you defend it. If you defend it as on sort of 14th Amendment grounds where this is equal protection under the law, yeah, that's one way to look at it. If you defend it on First Amendment grounds where I object to it because it violates sort of my religious freedoms practices, maybe not so much. And that's why it's a really complicated issue. And the incendiary discourse doesn't help.
There are two communities where same-sex marriage is very unpopular, more unpopular than even in the white community. It's the African-American community, and it's the Hispanic community. I want you to tell me about the impact in those two communities, which are the key to carrying major industrial states. I want you to get your answer and everybody else's response to that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Our Democrat tonight is Philip Beverly. He's an associate professor at Chicago State University for 18 years. He teaches political science and a frequent guest on this program. Dan Proft also joins us. Once upon a time, he was a frequent guest on this program. He loved it so much, he has his own show with Bruce Wolf every day in the middays at WLS, our flagship station. That's 89 WLS in Chicago. And also joining us is Sean Bennett. Once upon a time, he was that of the Log Cabin Republicans in the city of Chicago. And now he is in the arbitrage business, Bennett Arbitrage, and also in the Jingle business. Mm-hmm. And a card-carrying libertarian, if there are such things.
Slash independent.
You don't organize. By the way, yep. A reminder, as you have know if you listen to this program, you know we do this program live from the Museum of Broadcast Communications every Sunday night, and I'm happy to report that 1 month from today, we are officially opening on June 13th, but the night before, on June 12th, which is our 25th anniversary, from 6 to 10 o'clock at night, it's going to be an all-star salute, 25th anniversary salute to the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Betty White will be here, John Mahoney, Hugh Downs. You can order your tickets at museum.tv, museum.tv. We're going to have a lot of stars in place. And again, that's 25 years ago. Last night was the big party, and 25 years ago today, we opened at River City, or 25 years, in a month from now, I should say. And we will do it again. It'll be the third time we opened on June 13th in our history. So we're going to get it right this time. And I can tell you, it will be the last time I open the museum. I'm not going to do it anymore. That's it. Three times is enough. Let's go back to calls, or let's take calls. Let's go to Steve in Grantham, New Hampshire, listening to us on WNTK, one of our oldest affiliates. Go ahead. You're on the air, Steve.
Thanks, Bruce. All right, first of all, I'm married, 3 kids, 4 grandchildren. I don't understand. I'd like to ask Dan 2 different things. So hopefully I get out my points and then he'll respond. One is, on gay marriage, who really cares if gay people are married? How perfect are all these evangelicals in their married life between affairs and divorce that they are to sit in judgment of what other people will provide happiness to other people? It's an issue that I don't even understand.
All right, let's let him respond to that, and then okay. Go to the next question.
Then I have a second point.
Yeah, the it's not about people sitting in judgment of other people. It's either an institution means something or it doesn't. And I think what the effort to redefine marriage does is really destroy culture. And what I mean by that specifically is what it really is about is separating procreation from marriage. And if you want to know how separating procreation from marriage works out, all you have to do is look at the illegitimacy rate in this country. Take the black
community. Which is going down, by the way.
Take the black community specifically. When you separate procreation from marriage, as in the black community, you have 70% illegitimacy rate. That leads to all kinds of other societal problems that none of which are particularly good. So to me, it's about the institution of marriage, an institution that predates the state, that the state was set up to protect because people understood it was a building block of Western civilization.
So,
it has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with somebody is who loves who, or somebody cheats on their wife or doesn't, or what evangelicals think about gay people. It has to do with respecting the institution of marriage, which is foundational, and which if you believe in God-inspired that if you believe in natural law, essentially, you understand this is a natural right and should not be redefined based on the political zeitgeist of the time.
Steve, Sean yeah. Bennett has a comment.
Yeah, good. I would love to hear, because it sounds like nonsense to me.
Yeah, well, that's a very substantive response, which is what you're
well,
you've clearly thought about this.
You.
You've clearly thought about this deeply to come up with such a robust substantive response.
Let's let Steve.
I'm
going to give you your opportunity, but let Steve respond, and then we're going to go back to you.
Romney is in favor of gays and lesbians being able to adopt. Could you not agree with me that it would be better for a stable, loving, married gay couple to raise that child than a single gay parent?
Than a single gay parent? A single gay parent versus a gay couple?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, they're circumstantially specific, but the idea is that the model...
Because that's exactly what you're saying when you're saying it destroys culture.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the idea that you separate marriage from procreation is redefining marriage into something that isn't. You can call men, women, and then it just destroys the meaning of the word women. So the idea that you can do this, 15 years ago, nobody was even talking about redefining marriage. Now, all of a sudden, 15 years hence, this is something that must be done as an evolutionary stage.
Frequently,
and this is ridiculous.
Frequently, that's the ridiculous. Extreme right tries to evoke natural law in this debate, as you did.
Well, natural law, not just on this debate.
And there's something of, in psychology, we would call this the naturalistic fallacy, because if you look at, or if you believe in, evolutionary theory, you would see that humans are not by nature a monogamous species.
Where do our rights come from?
Well, from a basket of common law and natural law predicates from former cultures.
Oh, natural law. So I'm sorry. Do our rights come from natural law, or do they come from the state?
So because something used to be a certain way, does that mean they have to be a certain way now?
No, that's not what I'm arguing. I'm arguing is substantively. You're not clear on whether you believe in natural law and our rights derive from God, or our rights are provided by the government so they can be taken away by the government.
I'm saying that you're employing a naturalistic fallacy by presuming that natural law is better in the terms of supposed destruction of culture by the LGBT
community.
That's right. You're right. I am saying
Bruce,
that.
I can't let it pass that when arguments like this are made and two events sort of happen contemporaneously, it's very convenient to establish causality without having done the adequate sort of intellectual inquiry about it. So the presence of illegitimacy rates in the African-American community leading to other sort of social ills, those are just two phenomena that could be existing contemporaneously. It doesn't mean that one caused the other. I'd let you finish.
Go ahead.
There are several other factors that you won't speak of that are external to the community that could be leading to some of those dysfunctions that you're implying, you weren't really explicit about it, that you were implying exist there. Since you're not part of this community, you may not see it that way. You can speak to whatever you want.
And how do you know what I will speak to or what I won't?
Because I just heard what you spoke to, which was intellectually incongruous.
Really? And so illegitimacy in the black community has been a positive thing?
I am value neutral. I'm simply speaking to your conclusions about one thing causing another.
Steve,
and that's fallacious.
That's
back
what
to you.
I said.
Steve,
that's exactly what you said.
Why don't you explain then illegitimacy, good thing, bad thing in the black community?
It's neither.
Oh,
it's a phenomenon that exists.
Got it. Okay. It's a phenomenon that exists, and it has no impact.
I think what Phil was trying to say is, I'm sure Steve, he agrees it's not a good thing in the black community, but the fact of it has nothing to do with the idea that the marriage has to be only between a man and a woman. And you took offense because I said that. I thought you basically mentioned nonsense. I'll give you one example. Procreation and marriage. I know, this is trite. What about people who are in their 50s and 60s who are not going to have kids? Therefore, marriage is not important?
I understand.
Because if the only reason is procreation, that's not going to happen.
We should redefine an institution based on that.
What about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Without marriage in the minds of many gays, they will not be able to have life, liberty, or their pursuit of happiness.
Well, look.
Where do you come down on civil unions, domestic partnership, and other things that are important, but suddenly they are not as politically important as marriage is right now.
Well,
and that has evolved. I think everyone would agree that that part of this discussion has evolved very, very fast.
Yes. And as we've seen, civil unions is just kind of this false intermediate step to ultimately get to where the gay community, or some in the gay community, not necessarily all, but and the left want to go, which is to destroy marriage by redefining it out of existence. But in terms of these other issues, nobody is here to tell people who they should love, who they should cohabitate with. I'm not interested in that. And all of the things that are argued about spousal benefits and visitation rights, all of that can be handled through contract law. It doesn't require redefining marriage out of existence. That's all.
I'd like to make a Mother's Day point. First of all, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there, and especially
Hillary Rosen.
And Hillary Rosen, who is a mother. She was talking about that in the earlier today. I especially want to say happy Mother's Day to the mothers who unconditionally love their children, including those who happen to find themselves in the LGBT community. And the point that I'd like to make, which ties it back to the Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Happiness clause, is that if a child finds themselves to be LGBT, grows up, falls in love with somebody of the same sex, is able to get a formal union with that person so they can benefit from Social Security, they can benefit from spousal benefits, they can file joint tax returns, don't you think they're going to turn around and be thrilled that their mother unconditionally loved them? They're going to turn around and support their mothers in old age?
I am supportive of mothers having unconditional love for their children, if that's your point. Because I don't understand what other point
you made. My point is that if you allow the gay partners to pursue life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness through a formal mechanism that gives them the same basket of rights that heterosexual married couples have, aren't they going to be more inclined to be part of that larger family unit and take care of their family members in their old age?
I don't know how the one necessarily follows, and I certainly would not exchange that potential benefit that you think may occur for redefining the fundamental building block
but
of Western civilization.
That's a cultural issue, which really comes down to family.
Yes, and if you destroy if you redefine marriage out of existence, then there is no ancillary benefit you're going to get that is going to be bigger than the destruction you wreak.
So is there a way, and then we do have to break, is there a way for two men or two women who love each other to have some degree of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as you would define it? I want you to define it when we come back after the break and find out how do they define it and how do they move on with their lives and feel that they are being treated equally in a country that prides itself on equality. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Dan Pfaff, before the break, I asked about the alternative, the option for loving couples, same-sex couples, to live their life. What do you provide them? What do you propose that they happen?
Is there something – I'm not clear that there's something I need to provide them. I'm happy to let same-sex couples live their life and pursue happiness as they see,
and
so long as they don't infringe upon anybody else's rights to the same, just like anybody else.
So it's all based on contract.
Yeah.
Contract can cover everything that their gay aspirations deal with right now.
Well, in terms of the issues that have been raised that redefinition of marriage is supposed to address, like, oh, I can't visit my partner in the hospital if they're sick. Of course you should be able to visit that person. I can't confer benefits. Of course you should be able to confer benefits to whoever you want, benefits that you've earned. So, I mean, all of those issues that have been raised to me are red herrings that can be addressed by contract law. Otherwise, I'm not interested in micromanaging anybody else's life. I'm just not interested in allowing somebody to redefine marriage in such a way that destroys the institution and the corresponding negative impacts on Western civilization and our culture along with it.
Two segments ago, I set up the question and I forgot to do the follow-up, so I'm doing it right now. In the black community and in the Hispanic community, the opposition to same-sex marriage, at least according to some of the statistics I've seen, is greater than it is in the white community. What does the president's position, how will that affect turnout in the black community and the Hispanic community, both of which have to be very high if he's going to get reelected?
It's not going to have any impact on turnout because it's not so simple a dichotomous choice. Oh, if you're African-American and you're against gay marriage, you won't turn out and vote for Barack Obama. If anybody thinks that it's that simple, then they misunderstand or just don't know anything about the black community.
Well, tell us more about it.
So there'll be some pastors that will come out and they'll blast the president. Oh, he's turned his back on his faith or whatever.
Right.
And they'll use all the biblical references to get people right. fired up. And people will look and see that it's Barack Obama and they'll be on side.
Just because he's black. What about the Hispanic community? What about the Hispanic community where one would suggest that in certainly the large areas of the large cities of the country, the Catholic Church is going to weigh in on this issue big time?
And in the Hispanic community, I think we have to be very mindful about what part of the Latino community are we talking about?
Mexican.
If it's only Mexican, will it have impact? I don't know. Are those numbers large enough to be that significant in terms of voters? If you are talking about the Cuban community, of course, they're going to not be voting for him anyway because Cuban Americans tend Republican.
I would say that the constituency, Puerto Ricans tend to be Democrat. The constituency where this could be effective would be in the Mexican community, which could affect states like New Mexico, New Jersey,
Nevada.
And in terms of turnout, I think that there's a whole bundle of issues that those voters will look at as well as this position and do some decision calculus about
importance to them. I think I can address both of your questions simultaneously by saying that what we should be doing is divorcing the federal term marriage from religion by not calling it marriage. If you have all heterosexuals and same-sex couples getting a federal civil union, and you just replace the term marriage in the statute and the code of the United States, then that basket of 1,138 changes that the Government Accountability Office found in 2003 that relate to marriage in the federal code, you can give people those rights. The black community doesn't see it as a religious issue anymore because marriage is in the church. The Hispanic community sees it as in the church. Everybody sees marriage as in the church, but you're not denying those rights to people in those states.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that device because I think it highlights what I'm talking about, which is the idea of redefining marriage out of existence. But the other thing I'd say, just to the Hispanic and black communities' views on this writ large, you know, over extrapolating, but where they've been impactful, they were overwhelmingly opposed to the redefinition of marriage in California. They were the reason that it went down in California. And so this is always interesting to me because when you hear the pushback from the gay community or from callers like the guy from New Hampshire, they're always going after evangelical Christians because, of course, Christians are the one group in this country that you can denigrate with impunity and get applauded for doing so.
But Muslims, you can do the same.
But in the black community, but that doesn't happen in the media. The black community and the Latino community, they don't see it as a civil rights issue. And they certainly don't like it, especially the black community, compared to viewed under the construct of the 14th Amendment, equal protection action. And so it's very interesting to me that nobody ever wants to go after the black community and say, they're bigots. The Hispanic community, they're bigots. Anybody who opposes marriage is a bigot.
Except Christians.
But it's only the Christians who are bigots. Obviously there's Christians in the black community and the Hispanic community too, and this is what informs their view. But they never want to go after the minority communities because it's not popular to do so, and it's certainly not politically intelligent to do so. But evangelical Christians or conservative Catholics, they are a target-rich environment, and you can denigrate them and call them myopic and small-minded and bigots as much as you want. And I just love that dichotomy, as the professor would say.
Professor, you agree with that assessment?
I think that the Christian community, especially the evangelicals, do take a lot of abuse. And given some of the rhetoric that comes out of that community, some of it's warranted.
But keep in mind that some members of the Christian evangelical community and Christian denominations are actually in favor of civil unions or gay marriage. It's not just a black and white issue.
Which ones?
I would say some Episcopalian churches,
some
non-denominational Christian churches, some
United Church of Christ,
Church of Christ,
right.
Sorry.
Yes.
Well, the liberal churches of the Protestant faith, right?
Right.
On that note, we are out of time for hour number one. All of our guests, they did such a wonderful job. They'll be back for an hour number two. That's if you're listening coast to coast on radio. If you're watching this program as a television show in Chicago, thanks for being with us, and we will see you next week. But the radio folks, stay right where you are. Another full hour coming up live from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Dan Proft, Democrat Philip Beverly, and Libertarian Sean Bennett. Program coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our email address, btb@museum.tv, and we respond to all email inquiries. And our website is www.beyondthebeltway.com. In hour number one, we were talking about President Obama's announced support last week of same-sex marriage. We were discussing the political ramifications of it. We talked about Mitt Romney's response to it, saying that culture does matter in his speech at Liberty University over the weekend. And one thing that we didn't get to, but we talked about, obviously, its political impact and the question of whether or not at least on the surface, it doesn't appear to be the type of thing that would get the president a huge bump in support, other than it solidifies part of his base, his liberal base and his gay and lesbian base, which is significant. And obviously, if you do that, it could help turnout in some states. But of course, whenever you have turnout on one side, it's red meat to the other side. And so evangelicals and other people in the country who are opposed to same-sex marriage, again, it energizes them. They write checks. They turn out. They get excited. And again, you have a wedge issue that becomes something that each side believes is positive to them. But when it comes right down to whether or not states are affected, in the Electoral College, I'd like to spend a few moments talking about 106 electoral votes, and they are in the following states. Excuse me, and I want to get everybody's reaction to whether or not what impact this issue will have in those states. Let me rattle them off first: Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Nevada. They're generally regarded as swing states. Maybe Pennsylvania is not. But let me ask, first of all, Dan Proft is our Republican tonight. Virginia, how will the gay issue play in Virginia?
Well, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the professor's position that I'm not sure that this is going to be animating a lot of votes. So maybe in very close races, it will have a marginal negative impact on the president, considering where the country really is when you put it to the test of the voters, as we've seen in 32 states. So, you know, when 60% of the country weighs in on a state by state basis, it gives you a pretty good idea where the country's at. But the interesting thing about
you think the overall numbers would suggest that in the general polling, you think that is that's skewed to California, Illinois, large states, maybe perhaps Florida, maybe New York, where issues of gay rights are.
Well, it's interesting, even in those states, California was one of the states that rejected the redefinition of marriage.
Well, it's important to remember that $42 million came in against Proposition 8 from out of the state, $32 million of which was from the Mormon.
Whatever. The money argument's both sides. I mean, the bottom line, it went down in a state that where Democrats run the table routinely. But the interesting thing, one other just interesting note about those states that you mentioned, which is very different than 2008, all those states you mentioned, Republican governors. That was not the case in 2008, and we were talking off air a little bit about Obama winning Indiana in 2008, and part of it maybe being the ground game that he had in new swing states, quote unquote, like Indiana. Well, there's going to be a much better ground game, much more infrastructure building in those swing states on the Republican side because of the changeover in 2010 than there was in 2008.
Philip, in the states that I just mentioned again, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Nevada, which states do you believe the president's position will be a benefit in November?
I think it'll help him in Wisconsin. I think it might help in Nevada. Ohio, for me, is such a toss-up because of the VP possibility of Portman being on the ticket. And so Ohio being in play differently. It might help in Pennsylvania. I don't know. I'm surprised that Pennsylvania would be sort of a swing state.
Why do you list them? This is your list. Why do you list Pennsylvania as a swing state?
Because I looked at a number of different polls about states that were leaning strongly Romney, states that were leaning strongly Obama, and I looked at the ones that didn't have a firm center in the polling. I don't have a strong opinion about Pennsylvania because it's kind of a toss-up for me that the eastern part of the state, the gay rights issue might matter more than the western part of the state. However, Politico, after the announcement made by Obama on Thursday in support of same-sex marriage, polled in Ohio and Florida. And in both cases, it was 46% Obama and 45% Romney. I cross-reference that with Intrade, my favorite site that I like to go to look at the betting on those two states. In Ohio, it was 60-40 Obama and Romney. In Florida, it was 55-45 Romney-Obama. So if Obama can benefit in Florida with its large gay population, its large snow owl population that may or may not be there more than 6 months of the year and vote in Florida, that could assist him with the key state of Florida. Now, you may have remembered a couple of weeks ago.
But again, if Rubio's on the ticket, then it throws everything off.
I don't even know if it would help that much for Rubio to be on the ticket in Florida. I don't think it would help as much as it would help Romney in Ohio to have Portman.
Right.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that. I agree with that. I mean, I think Portman is going to be the VP pick. I've been saying this for several months now, and I think it makes the most sense, not just because of Ohio, but also because it best fits into Romney's narrative of being the economic turnaround guy. I mean, Rob Portman's...
What about Pat Toomey?
I like Toomey. I mean, I would put him in the dark horse camp along with somebody like a John Thune.
We had a caller a couple of weeks ago who brought the Toomey up, and I thought that was a good addition to the discussion.
Yeah.
I actually think in the dark horse is Governor Christie.
Still.
I think that could reach out and surprise a few people.
You know, very popular, a guy who is giving, you know, there's a great appetite out in the hinterlands for people to be leveled with, and there's nobody who's done more leveling with people than Chris Christie, and to have a 56% approval rating.
And he's got a big appetite.
He does have that. it seems to be. But I mean, I just think... Just on the Portman thing, former U.S. trade rep, former OMB guy, successful business. I mean, I just think that fits with Romney's narrative. I think unless there's something we don't know about him, he would be kind of a straight-laced guy, non-controversial. And the last thing that Romney campaign wants to do is turn the race onto them as a referendum on the Republican team as opposed to what it should be and needs to be, which is a referendum in Obama's 3 years.
So a ho-hum selection. The media would view that as a ho-hum selection.
Exactly.
Well, he's a little boring.
But that's good.
Both are boring.
But that's good.
Right.
But Dick Cheney was boring.
Dick Cheney was boring initially. Yeah. Elections are about contrast. And so you have the guys that are boring but actually know how to do stuff versus the TMZ president. That's a good contrast.
The TMZ president that killed Osama bin Laden. We have to remember that. And it's interesting that the
– How can we forget?
It's interesting that the whole foreign policy thing doesn't get talked about much. The ending the Iraq War, getting the drawdown in Afghanistan done, Somali pirates, Osama bin Laden, the drone strikes that are taking out al-Qaeda leadership. That'll say something during the campaign.
I agree with that. I think on those particular points, I think the president is very, very strong. Very strong. Stronger than any Democrat has ever been in recent years. 1-800-723-8289. Back shortly from Chicago on a different topic. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us. Let's head west, northwest, Spokane, Washington. KXLY is the station. Mike, you're on the air, coast to coast on Beyond the Beltway. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Yeah, we got around 80 degrees here in Spokane today on this Mother's Day. And,
great.
And you know, pardon me. Yeah, my mom and dad loved me very much. And originally from Michigan, I was born in Pontiac.
Mm-hmm.
And a mother's love and understanding cannot be equaled. Dad loved Notre Dame football, perhaps more than church, I think. And my mother once drove 40 miles to watch me play high school football. So I was adopted and loved and spoiled. And, again, a mom and a dad, and the silent majority is out there, and this is going to be a factor.
Yeah, you're talking about as it relates to the issue of gay marriage?
Yes.
What about the point that Sean made earlier? Because there are many in this country, obviously, who do not have the loving parents that you had, and there are those that believe that if there's a loving couple, the key element is a loving couple. They could be of the same sex, and they wish to raise a child, and they wish to bring to the child a loving relationship, a stable home life. Is that not better than growing up in foster homes where you're moved from home to home?
Well, again, it's a definition of love, Bruce, and with a mom and a dad, the mother and the dad factor. And foster care, you know, you could argue that both ways. But again, it should be a mother and dad.
Do you not believe that two people of the same sex can love each other?
Well, it's your definition of love. No, in their own way they can, which is not the way love should be, how you define love.
Well, but again, how would you define love?
Well, again, it's between a man and a woman.
Well, no, that's marriage.
Natural.
I mean, love.
But again, man and woman with love itself. I mean, that's...
Dan, do you think two people can love each other?
Pardon me?
Of the same sex. I'm asking.
Do I think two people?
I want to sort of broaden this discussion out because it seems to me that you are bringing up a point that I think is at the core of much of the opposition to same-sex marriage. The concept that two people of the same sex can love each other is a concept you can't get your hands around. Am I correct? Have I summarized that correctly, Mike?
Yeah, you have. Yeah, right.
Okay.
Well, let's take Obama's own words on this week, which were to say that after consulting with his wife, after consulting with Sasha and Malia, realizing that he had many friends who were in same-sex relationships that he had seen in stable, loving same-sex relationships, he was now in favor of the same-sex marriage. I think that the most common cause of somebody not believing that same gender people can love each other is non-familiarity. I think that if somebody meets a stable, loving same-sex couple that has a kid that plays with Sasha and Malia and so on, that they look at that and they say, gosh, wow, well, maybe they're even better than a heterosexual couple's loves in some cases.
Yeah,
I disagree.
Well, I'm a big fan of... I believe, you know, the children shall lead us and all that, but, you know, consulting his daughters on this, I don't know. It's a little far-fetched for me, but do I believe that two people of the same sex can love each other? Sure. Sure. That's not the public policy debate. The public policy debate, to me, again, and I'll just keep saying this because I think it's been completely misreported, and nomenclature is important, is redefining marriage. Redefining marriage. There is no such thing as gay marriage. Marriage is either what we understand marriage to be, or it's not.
No, your point is to the political discussion and the debate that's on in the country. But I think we have with Mike is beyond that, where the opposition still exists, is the inability of people to understand the level of commitment that others people of different backgrounds can have. And that
well,
is
Bruce,
and
only,
sometimes
only
you may, sometimes you may not be able to do that. And by the way, I agree with you that in an ideal situation, a mother and a father in the home is a wonderful idea. But again, in this particular case, and again, and society has dramatically changed. And if you look at younger people, according to the most recent polls, if you look at younger people, they are overwhelmingly comfortable with the idea of same-sex couples. One of the reasons is they may go to school with them. They may have experienced more of their interaction. And they may be more comfortable with it, whereas older people like yourself, I would assume, older
you're
people...
You're right, 66.
Older, well, you know, you're younger than I am then. Okay, older people tend to be a little more traditional, a little more conservative, and you know that's the way it is, and let's not change it.
I would also say the influence of the media. I mean, you know, how gays are portrayed in the media on popular sitcoms, Modern Family, just to name one example, versus how, for example, Christians are portrayed or people
right.
who believe in the traditional definition of marriage, how they are portrayed. I mean, that certainly has impact on in terms of shaping views in the body politic. So that can't
well,
be discounted either.
It still
either.
Comes down to a woman's love, a mother's love, and a dad's love. I mean, they can't be equal. They can't be equal.
Okay, well, that is your opinion on Mother's Day, where I'm not going to argue against motherhood. I will not argue against motherhood on Mother's Day.
Yes.
Courageous stand. One thing I do want to bring up, and that is the statute of limitation on a candidate's personal life, their character as a kid. And it comes up in the wake of the Washington Post story, a lengthy story about Mitt Romney and what he did at the prestigious Cranbrook School, the prep school that he went to. And according to this lengthy story, he was quite a prankster. Some of the pranks went a little bit too far, at least according to some of his friends at that time, who have now gone on the record, given their names, and reported a story that shows Mitt Romney in an unpleasant light. And I guess you really can't define it any other way than bullying at best. Gay bashing would be at worst. I think that may be going a little bit too far to put that label on it. But it is the bullying of a gay student, again, when he was back in prep school. Is it important that we know this, Philip Beverly?
Does it say something about his character? Maybe. Is it something that happened 50 years ago that's going to impact whether he's a decision maker or leading the most powerful country in the world? I don't know. It seems like it should be a non-issue. What I was more concerned about was his sort of response to it, which seemed to have been with more levity than I would have expected. I would have expected some introspection or some reflection to say, yeah, that was pretty messed up what I did back then, and take it seriously, given the anti-bullying climate in this country right now.
Dan, what is your view on this story?
Well, look, I mean, the idea that this speaks to who what a 16-year-old does speaks to who they are when they're 66, I think is a stretch. I think it's a real stretch. I also found the story interesting that the sister of the alleged victim of his bullying, who the alleged victim now being deceased, the sister said she was not aware of the incident, that her brother never told her, but that she knows that he would not have wanted it brought forward in this and politicized in the way that it's being politicized. So that, to me, speaks a little bit to the nature of the issue as well. But I kind of agree with the professor. I would have said I think Romney should have said, look, 16 years old, did I do some stupid things? Did I do some things I regret? Yeah. And I've done a lot of things since then, you know, like every other human being.
Well, he did say that.
I didn't see that in terms of what Philip was saying, his initial response. But I mean, I think that's the point, and that puts a tourniquet on it, and you move on.
I have a little bit of a cynical outlook on the timing of this story, because it seemed to weave into the sort of narrative of the news this week
of
the gay issue, bringing up the bullying issue, which has been in the news for the last year. And I have a couple of points on it. First of all is, you know, we're never going to know exactly what happened in 1965.
No.
Right? We can't speak to John Lauber because he died in 2004. So we can't speak to the person who had their hair cut off. It does ask a question for me of character if you are willing to pin someone down and cut their hair off. Even if you're 16 years old, I think that many people out there who are your listeners who may have been bullied as a kid certainly remember who did it to them, when it happened, and it had a long-term impact on them. The problem here is I don't really know if Mitt Romney did it that way. He doesn't seem to remember if that's exactly how it played out or not.
Well, again, if the facts that were reported in the Washington Post as facts, mm-hmm. based on the interviews with four other friends who collaborated and agreed with what the way the story was.
So let's assume for a second.
Then why would any candidate, even at 66, even though it's 50 years after the fact, why would they acknowledge that they remember that? Because I think it's logical to say that, you know what, if you were a victim of that, that's something you would never forget.
Right.
And I also believe that if you did that, you would never forget.
But could we – yeah, I agree with you. And here's the thing. Romney graduated in the top 5% of his class in Harvard Business School while he was also getting a law degree there. He was already accepted to Stanford when this incident supposedly occurred, and his father was the governor. We're talking about a high-powered intellect here. Mm-hmm. The likelihood that he forgot shearing off somebody's hair is reasonably unlikely.
But also it has to be put in context that it was over 50 years ago. It was before he became more religiously involved with the Church of the Latter-day Saints. He was a missionary for 2 years. It was also before he met Anne, his wife-to-be, for many, many years.
And I agree it's a stretch.
That is a maturing process. So again, this goes back to what George Bush said. George Bush said when he was running, he said, "When I was young and foolish, I did things that were young and foolish." Back shortly from Chicago. From Boston, Massachusetts to Beverly Hills, California, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio, our flagship station, 89 WLS in Chicago. Republican Dan Proft is here tonight. He is a talk show host on our flagship station, WLS, every Monday through Friday starting at 10 o'clock in the morning with Bruce Wolf. 9 o'clock in the morning, 11. Sorry.
Yes.
I missed your first hour. I'm sorry about that. Yes, Democrat Philip Beverly also joins us from Chicago State. He is an associate professor of political science, has been there for 18 years.
Actually, 20. And can I give a shout-out to my mom on Mother's Day?
Absolutely, give it.
Me too.
Not me too. You're going to make me the bad guy. Gosh.
My mom, Arta Beverly. Hi, Mom. Thanks.
Go ahead, Sean. Give it out.
Mom, thanks for listening. Thanks for everything.
Dan?
Mrs. Carol Proft in Wheaton, thank you for everything. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Happy Mother's Day.
And for all of those who are listening whose mothers have passed away, as mine did many, many years ago when I was 21, obviously a moment to think and to reflect on all the contributions that she made to my life. Philip Beverly, as I said, is here, and Libertarian Sean Bennett. And Sean is with his own arbitrage company and also is involved in jingles and zingles. Let's take another call. Charlotte in Arlington Heights, Illinois, listening to us on 89 WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I oppose same-sex marriage. You know, if love is the only criterion, why can't three men marry who love each other, or a man and two or three women? Wouldn't that be fair and equal?
No, that would be bizarre.
It would.
Yeah, I think it would be bizarre.
Right, but I think the point is that this gets into the definition of marriage and the importance of the specific definition and the implications of the definition. And when you start deconstructing it out of existence trying to redefine it based on metrics that don't inform the institution, then there are consequences to that.
Charlotte, what do you think that two loving same-sex couples should do insofar as living their lives? You don't want them to marry, and do you want them to have a civil union?
I'm sure they can work out legally or contractually whatever is necessary for property, but I don't want to see marriage defined. I can go to the Bible, Genesis 2, right in the beginning of the Bible. That's where we get marriage. It says a man should leave his mother and father, mm-hmm. united to his wife, and the two should become one flesh. It's throughout the Bible, it's man and woman.
What about if people don't believe in the Bible? What should they be doing? How should they be reacting to that?
You know what? The left always tries to convince you that men and women are exactly the same, but they have different body builds, hormones, temperaments, reproductive organs, and they complement one another, and they're not the same. And I don't want to see a child grow up, if two men are married, to grow up without a mother. Maybe a child in foster care in the future can get in, be placed in a family with a mother and father.
What about the vast majority of gay couples who elect to not have children?
I have nothing, you know, gay couples can do whatever they wish, but I just don't want to see marriage redefined. There's an article right in front of me by Kel Thomas.
When you say they could do what they wish, I think that's where a lot of people raise their eyebrows, because that's part of this discussion that maybe in their view they can't do what they wish.
Well, there's a flip side to that too. I mean, the people who don't believe in the Bible, and so they want to have an institution be something different than what it endemically is. Well, then you're also legislating morality. I mean, the legislating of morality doesn't just come from the quote-unquote right. Every law is advancing somebody's moral code, somebody's worldview. So the idea that the left, by redefining marriage, or the gay community by redefining marriage, is not imposing its morality is fallacious. It absolutely is imposing morality. It's just different than the morality that is rooted in natural law. That's all.
Sean, you were going to make a point?
I was going to say that if you take it down to the contractual suggestion of our caller, that you have to write so many different contracts in order to cover the range of opinions and circumstances and events which can occur, that it becomes almost untenable to have a same-sex relationship that is legally defined in that way. If you do what we talked about in the first hour, if you divorce marriage from religion and you say marriage is in the church, federal civil union is a basket of rights that we're going to give to two consenting adults regardless of their gender, and we're going to give that to them equally so that their, you know, their taxes are done the same way, that their probate is done the same way, you eliminate the biblical objection, because you're no longer trying to tie this to a term that is fraught with such historical baggage.
It's a secular humanist argument. It's to eliminate religion altogether as informing our culture, and that's problematic to people for all kinds of good reasons.
And possibly why it didn't make its way into the Constitution when they were considering separation of church and state. And
does
it's not separation of church and state. The Establishment Clause does not say that. It's a misinterpretation of the First Amendment.
Does the ability of a gay couple to form a union, a civil union, if not marriage, for the sake of this conversation with you, Charlotte, do you believe that makes that couple stronger? Is that a stronger relationship? And maybe it is. Is it more monogamous? Because people want to get together, and maybe they do not want the lifestyle of what many would view as a party lifestyle within the gay community. These are people are really aspiring for two things that are primarily conservative. They want to join together in a bond of love, get the benefits of society that everyone else has, and oh, by the way, they would also like to go and fight and perhaps die for their country. These are conservative aspirations of people whose sexuality is different than yours, but their aspirations, I would assume, are the same as either your family or your son or your grandson or whoever, or daughter or granddaughter, who has fought for the country and who is happily married.
You're giving government sanction to this relationship. I think the government should be neutral. And in Illinois, they're getting all the benefits, insurance and so forth, as married couples. Is that right? I don't think so.
Okay. Well, the many, many voters, obviously, in many states have agreed with you on that particular point.
But what I don't understand is how Barack Obama said we should leave it to the states, but all the states have voted against it when they were given an opportunity in a referendum.
I think Sean Bennett has a question that he would like to pose to the president, basically sort of calling him out and basically saying, okay, Mr. President, if this is what is really in your heart after discussing it with your family, maybe there's a better way for you to demonstrate to the gay and lesbian community that you're really for all the aspirations and all the rights that that you purport to be. What would you like the president to do?
I want to challenge the president to take one of the clauses from DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which was essentially two paragraphs. The first paragraph defined marriage or spouses between a man and a woman, and the second paragraph basically said the states cannot infringe on each other. So if you take that first paragraph and where it says, we define the word marriage for federal purposes, meaning only a legal union between a man and one woman as husband and wife, I'd like to add the phrase, or a state-recognized same-sex marriage or same-sex civil union. By doing that, you are bringing it back to the states issue, which is exactly what Obama said on Thursday. He said, I do not want to impinge on the states that have said, no, we don't want same-sex marriage. But what you're doing is you're also doing what he said, which is that no federal act should invalidate equal treatment. That was in his quote on Thursday.
Cheryl, are you still with us? Cheryl is gone. I'd like to get a sense of just the whole concept of is it okay with you, Dan, if one or two or five or six or 13 states want to have this and the rest of the country does not? Is that okay with you?
No, it's not. I mean, 40 states, I think it's 40 states passed state versions of DOMA. Mm-hmm. So 80% of the country's weighed in on that. But no, I mean, look, this is not, this goes back to Mitt Romney's, I think, poor messaging in the immediacy of what President Obama announced this week, which was to say, I believe that marriage is the union between one man and one woman. That's my preference. That's what Romney said. It's not his preference. Again, the institution is either something or it is not, and it's either something
states have defined it differently.
Well, I understand.
In some southern states, you can get married, or used to be able to get married when you were 13 or 14 years old.
I also that's a different matter altogether.
No, but what I'm saying is, but the decision to make the rules vis-a-vis marriage are set by that state.
But I think you also run into, if you have this patchwork of state laws, I think you run into some full faith and credit issues too, if you're going to have the basket of rights or not really rights, benefits that Sean mentioned attenuate in some states, you know, if I live in Illinois, but not if I live in Indiana. I think that also presents
some
complications.
Well, the obvious next question then is with the Boies and Olson lawsuit on Proposition 8, which has been
in California,
right? California, which has been upheld.
Again, just a second. I'm going to let you set that up, but we're going to go to a break right now. 1-800-723-8289. Talking about same-sex marriage, whether or not it will affect the presidential campaign, and whether or not it would affect your campaign or your vote at all, especially if you're an independent. We probably have a lot of people who are either pro the president or anti the president. But is there anybody out there that's sort of still deciding how you're going to vote in November? And does this issue sway you one way or the other? 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Bonnie listening to us in Lakes of the Four Seasons, Indiana, listening to us on our flagship station, 89 WLS. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, I consider myself a Christian, but I'm divorced, and I have a family member who's gay. Mm-hmm. And I think to myself, it's very typical of people, and this is a general statement, so please forgive me, Dan, but it seems like people tend to like to pick on the smaller group of people. And what I mean by that is, if you ask an average Christian person, what is their personal problem with gay people and gay people getting married? And they feel that it's a threat to the family structure. And it makes me laugh because, you know, go to church, look at the person sitting next to you. 50% chance that they're divorced. Think about the girls having babies out of wedlock. Those are the things that are the threat to the family, not gay people who want to have a committed covenantal life with each other, with stability and, you know, and that sort of thing. The destruction of the family is not the few gay people who want to get married. They're the 50% of the population who gets married and then gets divorced, and the damage it causes to their children. And I can attest to that personally.
Look, the incidence of divorce is an issue. The culture of death in terms of the profligate abortion is an issue. These are all issues that are quote-unquote threats to the family. I agree. But again, I'm not the idea that anybody's picking on anybody is just, I just reject out of hand. I'm not picking on anybody. As I said, as I said previously, people who understand this argument and the importance of the institution of marriage are doing this to protect the institution of marriage, not to micromanage anybody else's life. And as I mentioned previously, the institution of marriage predates the state. The state was created in large measure to protect the institution of marriage because people understood that to be the building block of Western civilization. And so because some people practice marriage poorly or it doesn't work out, that doesn't change the essence of marriage. It just says those people didn't behave or it didn't work out for whatever reason. But it doesn't change the fact that it's still a man and woman coming together, that procreation is attached to it because, you know, procreation is kind of important for the propagation of the species. And that's fundamentally different than a same-sex relationship.
Dan, do you believe, again, because frequently when you've been a guest on this program, we've talked obviously about Supreme Court decisions. Do you think that this issue is eventually going to go to the Supreme Court? And if you had to bet, where would you bet the Supreme Court would come down on the issue of the constitutionality of gay marriage?
Well, I would think it probably will go to the Supreme Court at some point. Antonin Scalia was prescient when he said in the Texas v. Lawrence decision, the sodomy law in Texas, that you're opening the door for the redefinition of marriage, and that's precisely what's happened. So I expect it will be litigated. Of course, the composition of the court makes a big difference. I mean, I think Roe v. Wade is ultimately going to be overturned, but that's going to depend on the president and the composition of the court in the next decade, I think. If it was the court right now, I'd say that they would probably either demur and take the kind of the middle position of leaving it to the states to and the state legislatures to make law in this area as opposed to issuing some kind of federal edict. That would be my guess.
I agree with Dan on that, and I think it's going to come down to Kennedy, if he's still on the court, as to whether or not that middle of the road decision is going to occur.
How do you think this?
I agree. The court
ultimately to the court.
Ultimately to the court. Yeah.
Well, we're almost already there.
Very close.
Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion, affirming Walker's decision with Boies and Olson, who, for those of our listeners who don't realize this, Boies and Olson fought on the opposite sides of Gore versus Bush, but they're on the same side of this in favor of Proposition 8 being overturned in California. That this is ripe for going to the Supreme Court anytime, really, at this point.
So, are we correct in saying this is going to happen? This is something that is eventually going to happen in this country.
I think it's inevitable if they look at the terms of the case that it would probably come down to states' rights.
Is this inevitable, Dan?
I don't think it's inevitable. I don't think anything is inevitable. I think it's probably trending in the direction of the redefinition of marriage, despite the 32 states that have rejected it by popular vote. But I think it's partly because of what you mentioned previously in terms of the polling among younger generations. I think it's trending that way, but nothing is inevitable.
Well, keep in mind,
does the fact that the president made this decision that he was going to bring this up and put it on the table as an issue in this campaign? You said a little bit earlier you thought maybe it's part of he wants to diffuse the issue. He wants to take the pressure off looking at his record. But as you look at it as a defining issue and as an issue that is, again, going to move votes, and I want to come back to the question I began this broadcast with, is this a plus or a minus on the does it make Barack Obama more or less likely to be reelected, in your view?
I think it makes him less likely to get reelected, but it's going to be important, very important, how Mitt Romney messages on the on this issue to consummate that opportunity.
Philip Beverly, answer to the same question.
I think it would be more given his target demographics where he's really trying to boost turnout.
I think it's more likely because I think enough Americans know gay and lesbians who are impacted by this.
On that note, we are out of time for our Republican, Dan Proft. He's a talk show host on WLS, 89 WLS in Chicago. And Philip Beverly from Chicago State University, and Libertarian Sean Bennett. They have all been with us this week on our program. Again, a reminder, if you want to come see Betty White, opening of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, you can go to our website, museum.tv. She will be in town on June 12th, and on June 13th, she'll be here to cut the ribbon, along with Hugh Downs and John Mahoney. I'm Bruce Dumont. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Tom Veracruz, Khalil Palil, and Dan Dorfman made this program possible. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.